apologetically at the fabric of the shirt he wore. "Yuri went to Rainbow City," I said, not waiting for him to speak. "Your father knew. They all know. All the parents. They don't want us to go." His face puckered in confusion. "They're afraid of the rainbow bamboo. And they're afraid of me," I said. "Sleep with me tonight." He stared, mouth open. "With a hunting knife," I added. He blinked, then nodded. It didn't matter whether he understood why. I went to see Octavo. Blas said he was better, but he didn't look better. The side of his face had collapsed, and he spoke thickly. Saliva dripped from one side of his mouth.
"Girl, you are hurt."
"Vera is having people attacked. You know that. Remember Julian. We have to stop her." His good hand stroked his face, as if he were tracing the edge of the good part and bad part.
"We expected paradise. To find paradise. Do you know what you found?"
"A better place to live at the city. You didn't want to go there. But I do. We do."
"The bones you found have DNA. Pax uses RNA. That is why it was the only city. Astonishing. Not from Pax. Others looking for paradise."
It took me a moment to understand. The glassmakers were aliens? Like us? I didn't know what to think, and I didn't have time. "We have to stop Vera. Can you help us?"
"Paula made herself a leader. Vera never learned. But no one did."
"Can you help us?"
"Help you what?"
"Go to Rainbow City.
And escape from the parents. The bamboo is even smarter. You will do what it wants."
"The bamboo isn't that bad. You haven't even seen it."
"It is. It is. It will make you stay."
"It asked me to stay. It needs water. It needs gifts. It needs us. The glassmakers liked the rainbow bamboo a lot. You can see that in the city. It can't be worse than here." He seemed to be looking at me, but I wasn't sure. "Help us," I said. "Tell the truth. That's all you need to do."
"Tell the truth."
He nodded unsteadily.
"Yes. The truth."
"Thank you."
"Your future. Not mine."
He seemed unhappy. I kissed him on his good cheek. Blas told me he'd recover. The stroke wasn't as bad as it seemed. He fussed over the cuts on my face and pretended to believe me when I said nothing else was hurting. I was trying not to think about it, but I couldn't stop, and wasn't thinking just about me.
"It's not right," he said. "What do we do?"
"You'll see," I said, although I still wasn't sure what I'd do. How would the parents react when Octavo started talking? Or the children? We children respected Octavo, and some of us liked him, but the parents would try to hurt us. Again. Octavo was dozing when I left the clinic. I walked to my room through the tiny huddle of ugly hovels that was our home. Plants bribed us, but they didn't beat us or attack us. Alosha was waiting in my room, and during the night he held me tight every time I woke up trembling, dreaming I was in an Esparto field. In the morning, we learned that Octavo had died. Vera had been with him. A lot of children doubted her story, and when I whispered to them about the city, the fruit, about what Octavo had said, and what he was going to say, they understood what had really happened. The parents knew about the city, and the aliens, and were afraid. Afraid enough to kill again. Who'd be next? We had to stop them. And I could. I got ready. Octavo's funeral was that evening. We marched at the pace of the slowest parents, shuffling with their canes and crutches through fields that sparkled with glowworms. Those fields, those ragged patches of green, were their only hope and accomplishment. We were silent except for sobs, and I cried too. For Octavo, or how bad things had gotten. They had attacked me. They had killed Julian and Octavo. If I didn't act, it would get even worse. Octavo was lowered into a grave next to the snow vines that he had hated. He, more than anyone, wanted Pax to succeed, Vera said. He searched for food crops. He helped us understand our place in our new home and how to live here in peace. He gave us his mutual trust and support so we could live in a new community and make a new society. She was quoting the Constitution, words she didn't believe in. I got ready. She turned to pick up a shovel alongside the grave, not even considering that someone would speak, especially not me. Octavo was a liar, like the rest of the parents, I said. She turned. How dare you? You all know this city exists. You've known it all along. She raised the shovel like a weapon, teeth bared. She stood several meters away. I ran toward her, pulling the knife with a poisoned blade from a sheath inside my shirt. The wrinkles on her cheeks lined up in waves as she shouted, Step back! She didn't deserve to be obeyed. I battered away the shovel. It fell to the ground. Stop her! She screamed. She can't do this! But all I could see was everything that had happened, and everything I could stop. I raised the knife and brought it down. The blade bounced along her ribs horribly, and she wailed like a swooping bat until I twisted the knife and forced it in with both hands, and then pushed her into the grave. I took a deep breath. There was still more to do. I turned to see Alosha and Blas wrestling with Vera's son, Ross. Brian already lay on the ground yelling, and Nicoletta stood over him, holding his cane like a club. The parents squalled that I'd violated this or that, and Nicoletta and Cynthia shouted back that I was right. The little grandchildren were shrieking, and Higgins stood in front of them, fists raised at the parents. Vera whimpered and was quiet. Was that how Julian died? I couldn't look into the grave. The new Pax was beginning the wrong way, and I had to do something. I raised my hands, one of them with Vera's blood on it. Children's voices called for quiet. They all knew the city was there, I said, and they were afraid. Something happened to the glassmakers, and they blamed the rainbow bamboo. Brian began to say something. Quiet, Nicoletta told him. I continued. But that's not why the parents lied. They had a dream. They wanted a new society, a better version of Earth. They thought they could make it with hardship, and the more hardship, the more they thought they had a new Earth here. That's right, Brian called out. But it's not working, Nicoletta said. It's not better. They have their new society, I said. It is us. We can make our own choices. Us, the children. Octavo asked me if I wanted a life worth living. I do. There's a better place to live than here. It's time for a new moderator. I looked around. Everyone was still, watching me. Who wants Pax to be more than endless hardship? I said. Who isn't afraid to change? Vote for me. I'll be the moderator, and we'll do more than survive. The parents wanted a new Earth. What we want is Pax. The time of the parents is over. Vote. Hands went up for me. Alosha, Rosemarie, Daniel, Leon, Nicoletta, Cynthia, Anaya, Malona, Victor, Epi, Blas, Ravi, Carmia, and Hrock. And Higgins and many of the grandchildren. And one parent, Ramona. I didn't call for the hands of those who were against me. So that was the revolt. I became the moderator by a minority vote. And in spite of the fact that at 18, I was 7 years too young according to the Constitution. But by the time we'd moved everything to Rainbow City, I was actually old enough, and Alosha and I had had two healthy babies. Vera's son, Ross, was probably one of the men who attacked me, but once he saw Rainbow City, he wanted to stay there, and he worked harder than anyone to get it ready. By the time we left the village for good, only four parents were still alive. I didn't want to abandon them. Although their half-blind eyes looked at me as if I were a murderer in those final days, we even offered to carry them. When I left the village the last time, the sun was rising bright red. When it set, we were camped in the valley above the waterfall. The bats began to swoop and wail, and I heard Vera dying again. It was the end of Earth.
Higgins and the Bamboo. Year 63, Generation 3. We understand that we must endlessly make choices, and that our choices have consequences, and that we are not guaranteed health, happiness, or even life. From the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pax. Higgins. Beck did right to invite me to the birth of his third child, since I've helped at 24 other births, including a Fippa lioness once, almost my last mistake. Beck and I are best friends, and besides, I was the real father, and would have made a far better father and husband than him. There's a stage in childbirth just before the real pushing starts when women often panic, and they don't mean the things they do and yell, although if it were me going through all that, I might turn homicidal. Women are more solid than men that way. Indira. Beautiful, brown-eyed Indira, with hair that swirls and curls like water in a brook. Indira had endured hormones, heartburn, heartaches, and hemorrhoids for 325 days and then a half day of labor. She was curled up like a baby herself, teary and trembling in her always tidy house, where a crib waited for the wonderful moment. Beck hovered near the door for a fast escape, if necessary. Not the best husband, as I said, though a square-shouldered man, very fit for repairing brickwork and turning over soil. I'm much handsomer, ask anyone, and, better still, perfectly symmetrical from head to toe, which indicates very fine genes. Indira commanded Beck to open the door to the sleety weather because she was hot. She shrieked that her back had never hurt that way before, so something must be wrong. "Here?" I asked, caressing her backbone. She wailed something I decided was yes, and I glanced at the old medic, Blas.
"Probably just the baby's head pushing against the spine, nothing dangerous," he said. "Everything's normal."
To his relief, too. I began to rub just above those beautiful round hips, hands sliding on the sweat. "Here?"
"Don't stop," she said.
"Soon the baby will come. Soon, soon, soon," I crooned. "You'll hold it in your arms. Soon, soon, soon. Just relax. Just relax." Indira wasn't the relaxing type. But Fippa lionesses usually are. So a few months earlier when I heard Clay mewling deep down, tired and hopeless, I'd have run because I'd guessed her problem, but I didn't want to spook her. We kept a herd of 12 adult lions and their young a bit upstream to fell pines for firewood and to clear new fields, and I was coming for my evening check, being the animal-responsible guy. People worry most about the lion's front claws, and they should, agile scythes that they are, but they do mere detail work when the lions dig up roots. The back claws are only as long as your fingers, but they inhabit the end of those muscular hopping legs. A lion can rip out your intestines and toss them over the dome of a house with one kick. Or, with a bit more effort, it can knock over a tree. Clay lay on her side, curled up and twitching in a nest of logs and leaves. Lions don't have the brains to need a big head, so births shouldn't be hard, and generally the big Phipps and I kept a respectful distance from each other. The rest of the herd was keeping a respectful distance from her that night, too. Idiot that I am, I approached, mimicking the coos of their chatter. "What's wrong, Clay? What's your problem, honey? Things aren't working right? Let me take a look. I won't hurt you. Just relax. Just relax." I touched her claws the way they do for greetings and cooed and petted her long fur and let her sniff my face. Her prehensile lips curled in pain with a contraction. Her eyes blinked, exhausted and drooping, and she mewled again, terrible breath, which isn't at all characteristic of a healthy lion. She held her back legs tight to her chest, and her fur dripped with blood and birth fluids. "Don't worry, Clay. We're fine here. Let me look. Let me look." I pushed on the legs, and she opened up a bit. "Just relax. Just relax." A little arm, covered with slicked blonde fur, stuck out of the slit just below her sternum. Three precious fingers tipped with pearls, ready to grow into claws. Lions should be born head first, like humans. This was bad. I touched the hand. The fingers flexed. Maybe there was a chance. I stroked the abdomen to get a feel for how the cub was located. Mama's claws began to stroke my back, very gentle, just returning the gesture. The cub wasn't fully transverse, near as I could tell, unless I was mistaking a tense stomach wall muscle for its head, very possibly so. But she was dilated, and maybe, I could ease the baby out. The lead male, Pittman, at the edge of the clearing, growled and rasped his claws on the ground, watching me. I massaged a little harder, and her claws caught the collar of my coat and began to tear it. "Just relax. Just relax. If that makes you feel better, tear all you need." I was kneeling beside her, a very easy reach for a back foot. "Just stay relaxed, honey." I pulled a bit on the arm and kneaded on the outside to try to move the head past a hump, but I couldn't. It was close, and she had a contraction, but we accomplished nothing except probably to make things harder on the baby. Clay whimpered to break my heart. Without much thought, I pulled up my sleeve and reached inside, hot and slippery and rippled with muscles. The head so close, and she ran her claws through my collar and coat and ripped fringe. My fingers closed around the cub's head, around the snout, guiding it up next to its extended arm, and she suddenly pushed and I pulled. Pulled on the arm, on the snout, in the canal. Her claws reached into my hair, the snout out now, pink. Her claws like razors on my scalp and my hair falling onto my shoulders. The whole cub's head out with another push, and I cleaned the little nose and mouth, and she pushed again, more claws tearing my coat. And the cub's body was out, and it took a breath and yelped, and I showed it to her, a boy. And set him down, and the claws flew from my hair, and she was licking him, and he was licking her, both weak but excited, and I backed away slowly, cooing. A cute, happy baby. A good day's work for a fine mama. Pittman came toward me on all fours, growling. I stood up. He rose on his hind legs. My eye level was his chest level, so I was at an undisguised disadvantage. He could hop faster than I could run, so running wouldn't get me anywhere. But I had always had a feel about lions, the way I did about cats. The glassmakers, or someone, had domesticated both of them. Pittman probably knew how to be number two if I knew how to tell him I was number one, or so I thought. I took a step forward. He raised his claws, and my disadvantage became all the more clear. I growled and raised my hands as menacingly as I could. Puny, fleshy fingers, and I wondered if lions could laugh. What I needed was a big stick, but if I bent down to pick one up, I might get sliced to string. But he only wanted to assert authority, so he reached back with a foot and kicked a tub-sized mess of dirt and rocks at me. I saw it coming and caught it in an intact part of my coat. I grabbed out a rock and threw it hard right at his sternum, aiming for his manhood, and I got lucky one more time. He howled and doubled over but stood right back up and flexed to lunge. I threw another rock at his pointy nose, which I hoped would be even more tender than his manhood, hit it luck on, and he was down. To make my point, I heaved the dirt in my coat on him. He stayed down, bloody snouted, the new number two. I walked around the clearing, holding out a hand to the other lions, but I had to force it to stay steady. A few young males sniffed, and I held my breath, waiting to see if they would decide to make their own challenge. The entire pack kept its eyes on me. No challenges. I petted Clay and the cub, and left with all the swagger I could still manage. And so, at nightfall, I arrived back at the city, torn and sheared and bloody, and in a cold sweat and breathless, realizing that I had used up a full year's worth of luck. In fact, I could have been killed right there, domesticated or not. Even cats can kill, let alone lions. And what kind of idiot was I? The idiot who won. But was the prize worth it? Indira came running down the street.
Hig! Hig!
And when she saw I was all right, and it was just Clay's blood, she went back to her loom, always a hard worker. Women are solid, but not always about what I wish they would be solid at. She was already pregnant. And now Indira was in childbirth and had decided walking might make her back hurt less, and it did, and soon she was on her hands and knees, pushing. Beck, a purely decorative addition to the room, still hung by the door. I knelt in front of her, wiping sweat from a face that I sometimes see before I wake up in an empty bed. And she chattered now, breathing normally without having to be reminded to do so. Blas sat on a chair behind her, holding a mirror so she could see herself work. Another medic waited among towels and warm water and blankets and diapers, ready to spring up with whatever was needed, meanwhile tending the fire to keep everyone warm. Beck leaned out under the doorway from time to time for a few words with someone outside, as far away as he could get without a total cowardly retreat. The head crowned and emerged, then one shoulder, two shoulders, wet and wonderful, and then the whole baby. Blas and I cleaned the child a bit, checking it quick, and Indira dropped into a cot to take the baby, a fine girl with good lungs. Indira and I marveled at her. Then the medics did, and Beck finally got the grit to come over to look, all of us awestruck and congratulating each other. That kept us busy until the afterbirth. A new baby girl. I didn't know what Indira and Beck were going to name her, but I was ready to sing her songs and shear a lion for wool for fuzzy slippers so those delicate little feet would stay warm day and night. Indira's mother peeked in to say she would get their other children. I helped tidy up for visitors.
"She's cute,"
the baby's sister, Moon, declared shortly after arrival as she marveled over tiny fingers and ears. Moon was my daughter, too, 4 years old, and her brother, Lightning, almost 10, was my son. I have a fair number of children, the pack's curse of infertility still being a problem, but not for me. And since I have such fine genes, spreading them around a bit won't cause special problems in downstream generations. I wiped up the floor and carried some equipment back to the clinic, growing more joyless with every step. The excitement of birth had ended, leaving me with my particular form of postpartum depression as I pondered the philosophical contradiction of a baby that was both mine and not mine. I could solve the conundrum with well-aged truffle. Lions won't eat fresh truffle roots, cloying and common though they are, I suppose because they smell like rotting trilobites. But the flavor mellows with fermentation. I collect what they dig up, boil it in water, and add a butter root, which the lions will eat, so I have to dig them up myself. Then after a few days, when it's done fizzing, I strain the stock into another jar, seal it with pine wax, and wait a month or more. The result is my big weakness, next to women, and my reliable consolation. I'm an expert at truffle. Good truffle smells like thistle flowers, like roasting almonds, like the river at sunset on a warm evening when you've had a good day and expect a good night. I grabbed two large jars from a stack in a bay in my house, not the biggest or best house in the city, but good enough for me. The dome had been repaired passably well, but four of the six side bays were beyond hope, and the walls were rebuilt plain and straight. Still, I had all the room I needed for a bed, a chair, a table, some tools, musical instruments, of course, and a whole lot of truffle. I carried the jars in my arms and my guitar slung across my back under my coat, and headed for the meeting house, the biggest building in all of Pax, a place where we guessed the glassmakers themselves had held meetings, with built-in benches all around and a roof so wide it needed columns. The winter sleet had turned to a frigid downpour, my clogs splashing in the streets, and the fringe on my coat was going to be dripping by the time I arrived. Fringe doesn't keep me warm, but it looks good on me, so I've fringed up all my clothes. And I enjoyed the walk anyway, or I tried to. The city has a special charm in the rain at night. The glass roofs on the houses glowed from the lamps and fireplaces inside, and the little candle in the lamp I carried lit a circle of raindrops and hinted at the gardens and bamboo growing around the buildings, the foliage skeletal in the winter and sparkling from the rain. A hint of the city rather than the solid reality of the city in bright daylight. You could hear more than you could see, though, if you listened. The splashes of the raindrops showed what was in the shadows. The curve of walls, the tangle of leaves, the flatness of pavement. It takes a good ear to appreciate the beauty of a cold, wet night. By the time I arrived, I decided that I didn't have the ear to truly, deep down, appreciate a nighttime walk in the freezing rain. Carilla, wearing a bonfire's worth of bamboo jewelry, kissed me on my cheek when I walked in. I knew those wide, soft lips. Warm lips. But she kissed me chastely, as if she had never moaned with ecstasy in my bed, and she was glowing with pregnancy now. My doing. Her husband, Orson, talked trivia with me about farm chores for Fippocats. Paloma, plump and squeezable, kissed me just as chastely, holding little Sierra in her arms. That was my little Sierra, with a smile just exactly like mine. Sierra kissed me too, and Sierra had her doll kiss me, a doll I had carved for her from ivory wood with joints that moved and eyes inlaid with agate. Other women kissed me on the cheek and asked about Indira and the baby, but only my parents asked me how my new baby was. No one has as many grandchildren as they do, but private is one thing and public is another. Spoil the party with resentment? Not me. All my children were there. Jefferson and Leaf had just lost a front tooth. Leaf had my brown eyes, but mine couldn't look that sad, could they? Tatiana had learned more multiplication tables. She was only six, but very serious about everything and quite tall for her age, neither of which she could have inherited from me. I had given Hathor some lion wood, which she spun and knitted into a hat, and her twin brother Forrest wanted some wool too. Orion wanted to know if what Tiffany said was true, that Fippocats understood everything we said, because Tiffany had a Fippocat that would stamp a paw the right number of times when you said a number, provided it wasn't too big. I said that cats were smarter than we all thought. Bjorn, always a quiet child, seemed fascinated by the growing quantity of food on the tables, and I stood next to him and shared the fascination. Indira's long childbirth had given the kitchen crew time to prepare. Pastries, two kinds of bread, sausage, smoked fish, three kinds of dried fruit, pickled onions, stewed birds, salads, eggs, deer crab, and yams. A great spread for winter and more food than we could eat. But we could try, after selecting the best tidbits to send to Indira. I set aside the truffle for Beck's arrival. I hoped he wouldn't be long, and at the same time I hoped he wouldn't leave Indira's side until he could offer no further comfort. Incompatible hopes that included the sincerest hope that he was finally doing something for Indira. He had disappointed me. I had hoped that with the third child he would have learned how to handle himself. He came as the children were starting to droop. They had eaten and sung and danced until even the Phippocats, green, furry little party lovers that they are, had hopped off to their hutches, their curled tails dragging. I had helped out every step of the way. Nobody knows more danceable children's songs than me, Uncle Hig. I had a new song about the moons and lux for the littlest ones, and even the adults joined in. Galileo is the silliest moon. It rises in the west, and it sets too soon. It can't tell time, but it's always bright. You can see it both day and night. The children perked up when Beck arrived.
The name,
they chanted, their birth party ritual.
Snow,
he said. Snow, I thought. What kind of name is that? Still, I kept smiling. Uncle Hig has to set an example. The children did their best to sing and dance to Snow, but they were ready for sleep. I slowed the song into a lullaby, and they followed my lead to flutter like snowflakes to the ground and lie still. Not long after, I opened up the jar and ladled out toasts, aged, soft, brown-red, and fragrant. Truffle for those inclined, and fruit punch and tea for those inclined to decline, or combine, as the saying goes. Time to celebrate a baby. Number 15 for me, 12 of whom had survived, and you'd think I'd get used to it, but every baby, not just mine, even lions, cats, bats, birds, and lizards, for billions of years and around the galaxy and universe, every baby is impossible to celebrate sufficiently. Truffle is a start, though. Sylvia raised a cup.
All babies are special, but Snow is a measure. Today there are now 100 pacifists. It's a wonderful number, and not because it's a nice even number. It's wonderful because the number keeps getting bigger. Snow is someone we always wanted, like all the babies before her and all the babies after, and like everyone here. There are 100 of us today. To Snow.
Pretty soon after two big cups of straight truffle, I asked Beck, "Why Snow?" I'd feared something stupid since he had named the other children Moon and Lightning. I don't know why Indira lets him choose the names.
"You disapprove?"
he said. "It has resonance with nature, I suppose."
"It's snowing in the mountains now, so I thought, Snow. You hate it."
"Snow?"
"Snow. My daughter. I named her."
I just wondered.
"It's my job to name her."
"You didn't do much during the birth. I suppose you need to take what opportunities are left."
"You know I hurt to see what Indira goes through."
"She goes through a lot. That's why she needs help."
"There are things I can't do."
"There are things you don't do."
"That's where you come in."
"That's not what I was talking about."
"But it's true. You got her pregnant. I do the naming."
"You sure put a lot of effort into your job, too."
"It's her name, Snow. My wife. My children. Your job's over."
I thought about that for a moment. He was right, although I would have preferred a real name like Anna or Rosemary, and real names for Lightning and Moon, too. In fact, I would have preferred a lot of things, and he stood right in front of me, and he hadn't done squat. But he got the rewards. He had given the baby a stupid name that I wouldn't like just to make his claim obvious, like Pittman kicking dirt at me. I punched Beck square in the face. He staggered a few steps, hand on his nose. I hadn't hit him hard enough. He was still on his feet and his nose wasn't bleeding much at all. He looked at me and laughed. I deliberated hitting him again. People were watching, but no one was stepping forward to stop me.
Hig.
He reached out to put a brotherly arm around me. I took a step back, but not fast enough.
You can scare the lions, but not me. You're the luckiest man on Pax. Women, children, truffle, whatever you want, whenever you want it.
By then he had me in a full embrace. He seemed to have drunk even more truffle than I. The angle made a clean punch impossible.
You're my best friend, Hig. Snow's a beautiful name. The perfect name.
If you say so.
I say so. Nothing personal.
Nothing personal. I felt disappointed with myself. I could have punched him better than that, couldn't I? But I hadn't. I worked my way free. I think I'll have some tea, I said, and Sylvia met me at the tea jar to hand me a cup of truffle, looking solemn.
I used to be excitable, she said.
I wasn't excited.
I know. That's good.
She invited me to sit down with her. I don't remember the day when she killed the old moderator and saved us, but my mother says Sylvia changed that day. I do remember the move to Rainbow City. I thought Sylvia was smart and powerful. I loved her in a little boy way, and it never wore off even as she got wrinkled and gray. We took a bench near the back wall, and I took a deep swallow of truffle. It's not fair, I said, a little boy again. I love Indira, and she stays with Beck.
There's no accounting for tastes.
She sipped her cup of truffle. I want a wife. I want Indira.
And Zoe and Paloma and Carilla?
Them too. Anyone. They should stay with me, one of them.
You know the mathematics. Men outnumber women. If you weren't fertile...
True. Yvonne and Tom probably stayed together because they had no other opportunities. I took another long swallow of truffle.
Women don't love me back. They use me. They know they can depend on you for anything.
And Beck, all the men treat me like I'm a woman's toy.
No, they see you with the Thippo Lions. You're the top lion. It impresses everyone. I'm impressed.
Right. Women love me, men respect me, lions fear me. Anyone looking at me from the outside might see things that way. I suppose I shouldn't have hit Beck. She shrugged.
It's not my business.
But the next morning, sober, I realized how she had made it her business. That evening I went out to visit the lions. On my way I listened to the bats flying overhead. Most hunters know a few words, but I understood far more. That night, though, they didn't have much to say.
Food. Where? Here. What? Bugs. Many? Yes. Come.
Pittman roared hello, and the rest of the herd echoed him. He trotted over. I had a big bowl of truffle roots for him, the stuff I strain out of the first fermentation, the rotting trilobite smell gone and replaced with alcohol. He gobbled them down, happy to be number two to a number one who brought such remarkable gifts. I had a little bottle for myself and sat on a log in a warm winter coat to sip it and watch the moon dance like a child's star. He set his long, narrow head on my lap, and I scratched along his bony crest. He cooed. other lions wandered over to flop around me, and their cooing became a chorus. I joined in, not sure what I was singing, and we serenaded the sunset together, a happy herd. Women lie to me. Men laugh at me. Big, dumb, hairy animals think I'm one of them. But children love me, and I have truffle. At sunset along the river on a winter evening as the auroras begin to glow, it tastes like the good times you can't quite recall, but surely they happened sometime. Maybe tomorrow. You just have to wait and see.
The bamboo. Growth cells divide and extend, fill with sap, and mature. Thus another leaf opens. Hundreds today, young leaves, tender in the sun. With the burn of light comes glucose to create starch, cellulose, lipids, proteins, anything I want. Any quantity I need. In joy I grow leaves, branches, combs, stems, shoots, and roots of all types. Water flows through the repaired foreigner's pipes like veins in leaves, freeing me from rain and seasons so I may develop at will. Water feeds fungus on my roots that generate nitrogen for amino acids. Water permits increased transpiration in leaves and thus higher photosynthesis, growth compounding growth and bringing gratification. Because of the foreign animals, I am more than yesterday, bigger, smarter, stronger, strong as I once was. In the city, I reign. Outside, groves and sentinels protect and feed me. I turn light into substance. Everywhere, I control the sunshine. Intelligence wastes itself on animals and their trammeled, repetitive lives. They mature, reproduce, and die faster than pines, each animal equivalent to its forebearer, never smarter, never different, always reprising their ancestors, never unique. Yet, with more intelligence, less control. The mindless root fungus never fails, but moth messengers come and go with seasons. Larger animals grow immune to addictions, and the first foreigners who built the city abandoned it and me without explanation or motive, just as we had begun to communicate. Did they discover my nature and flee? Or was their nature renegade? Their intelligence astounded me, far above that of other animals and plants. I could not have become what I am without their irrigation, protection, excretion, and compost. I suffered when they abandoned me almost 2 centuries ago, years that should have been prime. Forsaking functions to preserve my roots, for what am I without memory but mere grass? But what am I without pollen to communicate, without nectar to trade with moths for the bits they gather for me, without seeds and spores to disseminate ideas, without roots to touch from grove to grove, without lenses to see, without crystals to sense electric waves. Almost blind and numb, thirsty, crippled, yellowed by malnutrition, trapped in old memories too costly to maintain and too precious to let die, exhausting storage routes, I barely knew of these new foreigners. Day after day twinkled past while I hoped they might save me. Yet when they came, I was almost
fatally slow to adjust my fruit to welcome and tempt them. Unfamiliar in body chemistry, but decipherable. Moths brought me bits of flesh and I learned. Now I give fruit that makes the foreigners content and healthy, a complex balance between pleasure and utility. They give me water and nutrients, trained like phipocats by the snow vines, but so much more than phipocats, for they, like the first foreigners, make plants and animals their own servants. Indeed, tulips seek domestication, their minuscule intelligence aimed toward service, and I have encouraged them and other crops to serve the foreigners. And I have protected the crops from competitive plants. I would have died without these new foreigners. I will die without them, but I have seen that intelligence makes animals unstable. I must communicate with them, and finally I have the strength. I am growing a root to store what I learn, but it now contains little more than pith. I have not tapped their intellect and used it like phosphates. The sun rises. With my eyes at many nodes, I see them awaken, quick and busy. Many go to the gate near the river to leave for the fields. I observe color in their clothing. They see colors. They will see mine, grand and compelling, and know that I am no snow vine, that I have a significant and inescapable communication to enter into with them. Animals never grow smarter, but I do. Ours will be a rewarding relationship. The pollen in the wind, what little pollen there is, speaks of a wraith of leaf-eaters at the valley's farthest fern villages. One of my groves across the river reports that a pack of phippo lions has been led away from it, which I never doubted, for the lion's claws are a tool of my new foreigners, well controlled. Although I can easily teach lions to avoid roots and stems embittered to deliver the lesson. I listen for the electric snap of lightning. I await a taste of pollen or a messenger seed or a tidbit from a moth. But it is winter and much is still. Intelligence conquers the seasons. But there is little intelligence in the world.
Higgins. Even the bats were whistling with surprise. Our guard, making a routine Luxrise check of the city, saw the surprise and ran to tell Sylvia, who woke the botanist, Raja, and still in nightclothes and with Raja's children tagging along, they rushed to the riverside gate. Raja's four-year-old, Muriel, took one look and ran to wake me up.
"Uncle Hig, the bamboo did something pretty. Hurry!"
So I was among the first to see it and hear the story. Raja was already calling it the display, even though it was lit only by torches and far less stunning than it would be in full sunlight. Torchlight couldn't begin to reach the top leaves of the bamboo, but could still make your jaw drop. Along the road leading to the riverside gate, the leaves and stems of thigh-wide, sky-high stalks of bamboo had changed color, one stalk per color on either side. Red, orange, yellow, green, cyan, indigo, and violet. The bamboo had recreated a rainbow on either side of the road. I stood wrapped in a blanket, holding Muriel's hand. I knelt down to talk with her, since children prefer to talk at eye level. It's beautiful, honey. Thank you for waking me. Our breaths made clouds. I wrapped my fingers around her hand to keep it warm. Sylvia and Raja inspected the bamboo while Muriel proudly named all the colors for me. More people arrived, sleep in their eyes. A few Phippocats approached, thumping and licking the colored stems, hopping up to grab a leaf in their teeth and making a happy game of getting in the way. Raja's truffle-colored hair hung loose and still tangled from bed as she knelt down to look at the roots. A cat joined her in scratching at the dirt. Above, bats swooped and whistled, chortled, twittered, and warbled.
Danger? No. Pacifists here. What? Come. Bugs? No. What? Here. What? Here. Why?
Muriel said. She asks that a lot, usually as a gambit to offer her own explanation. Well, so we would notice it, I guess.
It's pretty. The bamboo likes us a lot. That's why.
I think so. Actually, I thought it probably meant something more subtle. It might not even be directed at us.
We should tell it we like it, too.
Yes, we should. But how? Sing it songs? Make it a toy? Muriel giggled. By sunrise, everyone was up, and some of us had gotten washed and dressed. Sylvia sent me to inspect the bamboo outside around the walls. I reported back during a formal briefing session in the meeting house. Most of PAX had come, and the benches were packed. Nicoletta was taking notes. I looked for anything unusual, not just at the bamboo, I said, in case it isn't about us.
Good thinking, Sylvia said.
Nothing, though.
Nothing for us either,
Raja said. She and a team had inspected the city.
But it's at a location important to the city and to us. We're supposed to notice. Anyone? Any observations?
A boy stood up.
The rainbow bamboo, I mean, the rainbow bamboo, it has no fruit.
Sylvia looked surprised and thoughtful, as if she hadn't realized it herself.
That could mean something important. Any other ideas? It likes us,
Muriel said.
That's what the colors mean, and we should say we like it back. That's exactly what I think,
Sylvia said.
We should respond. But how?
We all mumbled puzzlements for a few minutes. We knew the bamboo was smart, but how smart was smart? Notice exactly what? Respond how? Was this even good? Sylvia, never one to rush deliberations, talked quietly with Raja until we were done babbling, then stood and signaled for attention.
We all know that the bamboo has become much more healthy with us here. We've given it water and fertilizer, and it's given us fruit and keeps improving it. Now the bamboo seems to want our attention. I propose appointing Higgins to communicate with the bamboo for us.
I wondered if she had really said my name.
He can command lions. He can direct cats. He understands bats. And baby talk.
People chuckled.
If anyone can communicate with a plant, it's Higgins. If you consent, Hig, of course, and if that's the will of PAX.
She had said my name. If I consented. I knew Octavo's rules. Plants could see and think and all that, but plants didn't think like Phipps, even less like people, probably. I had no idea. And I might say an inane thing and insult it. I've never figured out how to approach musk mice without getting smelly, and what could an insulted plant do? Octavo's rules weren't encouraging.
Why, oh, why me?
Raja will be able to help you with the science,
Sylvia said.
You'll bring the intuition for the job.
But I could never say no to Sylvia, even if intuition wasn't anything like my specialty. Did I have the time? I had a charcoal mound burning, but it would need to smolder another 5 days before it needed attention. And there were bird hides to tan and beech tree galls to gather for tannin and woad to process for dye and pine trees to tap with the first warm spell for wax. But I could fit in a few more duties. Sylvia gave me an impatient look. Of course I'll do it. I was thinking ahead. It seems to have a lot to say to us. People voted yes and slowly left, still babbling. I stayed to work out the details with Sylvia and Raja, hoping I'd get hit by an intuition lightning bolt.
What do bats say?
Raja asked. Not much. Come here, go away, bugs, sex, things like that. At the mention of sex, I realized that I had never slept with Raja, and her breasts would fit nicely into my hands.
You trained the Phipps,
Sylvia said. I think she meant to encourage me, but I couldn't help being honest. No, someone else did that. Snow vines, maybe. Sylvia frowned. She insists that she doesn't mind any reminder of the original village, but she does, and I'd forgotten about that. There's not much to it, I said quickly, to say anything. I just watch them and figure them out. Your father left some good notes on domestication and fit behavior. Praise might smooth things over. She didn't look smoothed, but she talked like she was.
What makes you think the plant has a lot to say?
That looks like a shout to me.
Intuition.
I suppose. It's too big. The size worries me.
It's not like flowers,
Raja said, smiling at me, a smile sweeter than nectar.
The colors were made probably by withdrawing the chlorophyll and unmasking colors that were there. Although we've never seen it do that before. Something like it happened once,
Sylvia said.
When I first visited the city, although it was just a small branch with colored leaves.
My intuition had me ask, this is the same bamboo in the display as the rest of the city, right? Bad move. Raja looked annoyed by my ignorance.
All the bamboo is the same plant, all connected by roots.
Octavo's rules say plants always want something from animals, I said, and I managed to annoy Sylvia again, since she had a high opinion of the bamboo. I mean that in a good way. When I call the cats, I want them to play, that is, do some work, or let them know I brought food. It might want to give us something. She looked placated. A new round of sharing, maybe? I mean, the fruit keeps getting better for us, bit by bit. That actually charmed her. Let me take another look and think on it this morning. I took another look and couldn't think of a single thing. What did it want? If the plant had been watching us and figured us out, it might want to take something. And why so big? If it was meant to impress, it had succeeded. Orson had asked me to take some cats out to weed a cotton field, so I did that instead. I went to the cat hutches, played a tune on a panpipe made of rainbow bamboo, useful stuff, that bamboo, until about 20 decided to pay attention and led them past the display where we had to pause and look up in wonder. And we left the city dancing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, glide. I minded my back. Last fall, in a moment of inspired teamwork,
They had pushed me off the new bridge, a nice, wide, sturdy log bridge, the pride of the city's civil engineers. But transporting Phipps had been worse before we finished the bridge. I used to have to get them across by boat, and they figured out much too fast how to make the boats tip. Burdock was sprouting in the cotton field. Cats will gobble tender.